Robert Stark. I am joined here with Richard Wollstonecroft. Richard, it's great having you back on the show.
My pleasure, and greetings from down under, mate, on this lovely Monday morning down here.
I'm also joined here with Alex von Goldstein.
Great to be on with you, as always, Robert. And Richard, I'm excited to talk to you again.
Excellent stuff, boys. What's going on?
So we're going to be discussing aristocratic radicalism, transcendental fascism, and I think a good place to start off with is to talk about, like, Boyd Rice, Jim Goad, and some of these other people you mentioned, like Adam Parfrey of Feral House Books. Richard, can you talk about your, like, personal history with them? So let's start off with Boyd Rice, since he starred in your film, Pearls.
Yeah, look, I mean, I guess what I'm interested to maybe discuss a little bit is kind of like the genesis and genealogy of this movement that we're all sort of linked to some extent at the moment, the alt-right, you know what I mean, in a way. You know, there's been a lot of many discussions about where it came from. I have my own kind of personal thesis. Like, I began to see this kind of philosophy appear, I guess, around the 80s. It was beginning to be expressed by people like Boyd Rice and Jim Goad and in, like, very alternative press. Also, you know, also in research publications were put out by, you know, V. Vale and Andrea Juno in the 80s, like an industrial culture handbook. And in the book Pranks, there's just some other kind of like political kind of like cheekiness beginning to kind of like develop. And I was like, this kind of really interested me. And it really was a kind of reaction, I think, to the kind of 60s humanism and the 60s kind of left wing thing, which was beginning to, you know, really, you know, do its kind of, you know, broad march across the universities.
Well, what is
and, you know,
the difference?
Taking over, you know, campuses and, you know, I mean, it was still everywhere, left-wing stuff, you know, in universities in Australia. And I imagine it was pretty similar in the United States. So I began to see this kind of interesting rebellion and reaction beginning to develop. And I guess I began to kind of, like, start to listen to it, you know what I mean? And this is when I was a teenager in the 80s. And in the 90s, Boyd Rice himself began to be a bit more political. He released a very important album called Music, Martinis and Misanthropy that had this song in it called People, where he just it's an extreme anti-humanist song that really has almost some fascist kind of ideas in it.
What is the difference between this kind of 1980s anti-PC counterculturalism and, you know, the 1970s sort of punk rock movement? Because one could say that punk rock in a lot of ways was a reaction against hippiedom. So what do you think the difference?
I do think that this was, in a way, you could probably make a claim that the alt-right movement was born of the punk movement, because there's always been a kind of a bit of a right-wing punk thing going on. But, like, somehow, I mean, obviously there were, like, Nazi skins that were kind of a bit punk and things like that, but I'm not talking about that kind of more Daily Stormer end of things. I was talking about more something that's a bit more even avant-garde or a bit more intellectual than all that stuff, which I never was particularly attracted to skinhead movement. I always thought it was just a bunch of bully boy dickheads mostly. And this was something else I thought that was more intellectual and more challenging. And, you know, but I could say its genesis. I mean, I know, for example, Boyd Rice, you know, has his genesis in the punk movement. You know, he was obviously one of the first artists to be signed to Mute Records. And obviously, you know, also I could even say, you know, Genesis P. Orridge, you know, his early days. Obviously, he's now a kind of transgender kind of spokesperson. But in his early days, he wore fascist outfits and, you know, had a shaved head and, you know, espoused kind of very, you know, almost transcendental fascist kind of ideas, let's say.
What's so, fascinating about Boyd Rice is he talks very kind of very straightforward, and he doesn't try to put on, like, the image in the way, like, someone like Marilyn Manson does. Like, he doesn't cover himself with, like, tattoos and piercings. In some ways, he dresses he carries himself fairly conservatively.
I know, the Boyd's a really, really fascinating guy, and I actually really have got to know him quite well over the years. I mean, obviously, we collaborated on the film Pearls Before Swine, that I guess it could almost be called a founding movie of the alt-right in a way, you know what I mean? Like, you know, I think it's been a bit of a cult hit in certain circles, and, you know, it was something we pretty much collaborated on. As I said, I got to know, you know, through the song People, I got to know, you know, Boyd's work, and I began to study a lot of his noise music, and we began to correspond, and then I wrote the script with sort of him in mind, and then he agreed to do the film, and he was actually out in Australia recording an album with Douglas P. From Death in June. not many people know this, but Douglas P lives over in Adelaide, which is only about, you know, an 8-hour drive from Melbourne, 8 to 10 hour drive from Melbourne. So I just jumped in my car and drove over there one day, and I hung out with both of them, and you know, got to know Boy, got to know Doug, and they were both quite supportive of the project. Doug had a cameo in it, and Boy gave me some music and obviously played the lead and played a major part in it. He also wrote even some of the monologues in the film. Some of them I wrote, some of them he wrote. So it was definitely a collaborative effort. So it was a great lot of fun.
I'll put the song People on. Is that the song where he says we need a gardener, a brutal gardener?
Yeah, oh, yeah, it is. Yeah.
That is the song. I mean, maybe you could edit it and play a better version. That was a bit of a crap.
Oh, yeah, a brutal gardener.
A brutal gardener, basically. Yeah, that's obviously what he spoke about. And that line's in Girls Before Swine. So, obviously, this was the kind of thinking. And I guess as a teenager, I'd read Nietzsche and a few other kind of misanthropic kind of philosophers.
Well, what led you to read Nietzsche?
I was particularly annoyed with the 60s generation in the sense that I didn't see that it – I didn't see a world of peace and love. I saw a world of even within, you know, in a country like Australia that is basically mostly European, I just saw nothing but inequality even within the European community and animosity and, you know, anger and violence and, you know what I mean? Like, this kind of world of peace of John Lennon and Bob Dylan. I just thought this is just a load of absolute fucking bullshit. And we're being spoon-fed this crap by this 60s generation and a bunch of old dinosaurs and a bunch of cunts who are all just rich, running around, you know, like screwing people and being cunts. So I just thought, well, fuck them. And I began to become interested in this, I don't know. I mean, some people call it Dark Enlightenment. I've heard that name used. Obviously, Boyd, Douglas P., Jim Goad, even Adam Parfrey, who published the book Apocalypse Culture, I think was very influential on all this. And together, I think, from this milieu, which probably was born with the punk movement, I think the alt-right has come out of that, and you notice a lot of punk people in the, like Edward Olsen and, you know, Ann Sterzinger, they've got a definite kind of punk kind of vibe to them. And, I mean, I guess I too, probably a little bit, but I just think there's something interesting about it. And from this, I guess it's become the movement we're all part of in a way, you know?
Yeah.
What's interesting is you bring up like a lot of these kind of like punk figures or counterculture figures, because if you ask your average person who's like loosely identifies with the alt-right, they'll say something like all these like paleo conservative intellectuals. I've never heard someone say make the case that you have.
Oh, really? I mean, obviously, you know. I mean, Julia Savola is the great love affair that most of the people who like to claim they have an interest in the alt-right. I mean, what's the name of that chap who publishes the Arctos Press?
John Morgan.
John Morgan, yeah. I mean, they're so in love with Julia Savola, they should get married. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, I've read Julia Savola. Julia Savola's fine, but I mean, to me, he's just another interesting right-wing intellectual, of which, you know, there are. I obviously find someone like Nietzsche more influential, someone like Martin Heidegger more influential, someone like Ernst Jünger more influential, Carl Schmitt, some more influential. Obviously, then you look at some of the from the English world, people like Ezra Pound, T.S. Eliot, who like worshipped Charles Maurras from the Action Francais. Then you've got like you know, like the Italians, like Marinetti, and you've got Gabriel D'Annunzio. I mean, all these figures are fascinating. Obviously, Evola's part of that in a way. So
what about Aleister Crowley and Wyndham Lewis?
Yeah, Aleister Crowley, definitely. I mean, you know, I think, you know, anybody with an interest in the occult is not an egalitarian. I mean, I think this is important. I think, you know, I think one of the distinctive things you can say about the alt-right is it's anti-egalitarian. You know, we don't believe in a universal application of equality because I basically don't think it's ever existed nor ever will exist. And it certainly will not exist under a Hillary Clinton administration if that evil person ever manages to get up, which is only a week away. But hopefully Mr. Trump is going to trump her and, you know, we're going to have 4 years of fun, hopefully.
There's this kind of a false dichotomy.
I agree.
That you're either in egalitarianism and everyone's equal, or you have to kind of accept that the current people who have wealth, status, and power are legitimate, and that's kind of influenced by, like, Calvinism, but they're both bullshit.
I'm not a radical anti-egalitarian. I do believe, you know, that there's nothing wrong with having decent education, decent health care. I mean, you know, basically limited socialism that provides what could be considered a general basis for equality of opportunity so that, you know, I mean, because I'm a Nietzschean in relation to, as we're talking about before, aristocratic radicalism, you know, that I think from any class, someone with an aristocratic soul can arise. I mean, I arose, I guess, from the lower middle class, but I know people who've come from the working class. Boyd would have come from the working class. Some people can come from the upper class and be this way. And you're going to have people from the upper class who are just sheep, who just spend their life in a life of comfort and in a life of degeneracy. I think you can arise from any class. And so I agree with a certain extent with the idea of equality of opportunity, because I do believe great individuals can come from any class. So that, we need to do the best we can to kind of enable this kind of these great people to arise. And that is the purpose of society, not the protection of everybody, just to enable the great people, men or women, to arise and speak and to be heard and, to propagate their voices.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I did a show, we did a show about Crowley, and also I read Keith Preston's chapter about him in his book, Thinkers Against Modernity. He rejected egalitarianism, but at the same time, he saw kind of capitalism as suppressing like a genuine like elite of like the most creative people, and he supported a social safety net, but not from like a Marxist or egalitarian standpoint, but more to kind of like free up like the creative class.
Exactly, that would be my position as well. I mean, obviously, I did study Crowley a fair bit. I used to run a club called the Hellfire Club, which was a kind of S&M nightclub in Australia. And from this milieu, I studied a lot of the occult, a lot of the occult thinkers. And obviously, Crowley was the most modern in a way. And even though I never practiced any of his rituals, I was never into doing that side of things. But like, I certainly studied his philosophy. And I saw him as a kindred spirit. Though I don't necessarily agree with every one of his philosophies. He probably went a bit darker than I would go. But he definitely had some interesting ideas and was essentially a kind of libertarian, aristocratic radical, I'd say.
Well, I mean, I think an interesting thing about the occult is that you have an authentic occult and then the kind of mainstream version of the occult. And I think that's like a big delineation, you know, the kind of mainstream view of Crowley and what the occult is. And even like individuality, per se. I mean, that's a whole other thing. But yeah, could you comment on that, Richard? You just sort of authentic occult and the inauthentic occult?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, one of the reasons, I mean, I guess, you know, I mean, you know, everybody in life, you know, when you're a kid, maybe you believe in religion. And then when you're a teenager, you have your doubts because you're a teenage rebel. And I guess I became an atheist to some extent. And then I started the Hellfire Club as a kind of like a bit of a rebellion and a fuck you to everybody. And, you know, I mean, obviously I was kind of like riffing on almost satanic ideas at times. But then I did actually meet Kenneth Anger, the famous filmmaker and occultist, who is a true student of Aleister Crowley in the magical sense, who's been practicing the occult for, well, most of his life. I met him and he gave a speech at the Hellfire Club. And, you know, he spoke to me. He's a very sweet person. He's a very softly spoken individual. You know, he would say, Richard, you know, the occult, it's just like radio waves, and I know how to tune into it. And like, I just really felt that it was something real when I was speaking to this person. This person really was in contact with something. And it really began to make me think that there actually was something to the occult, and actually opened the door to me to think maybe there's something to mainstream religion as well, and Christianity, oddly enough. So it really opened my eyes. It wasn't just Kenneth Anger, but it was other people I'd met from that occult.
Well, Richard.
But there was truth to it, and this was absolutely authentic. Go ahead.
You know, you're talking about meeting Kenneth Anger and him talking about the occult being radio waves. Now, I've heard stories about Anton LaVey and that every woman that Boyd Rice would come to take, every woman that Boyd Rice would bring to see Anton LaVey, the next night they would have this dream that they were being fucked, for lack of a better word, by Anton LaVey. And every single woman who Boyd Rice brought to see Anton LaVey, they had this fantasy. So, I mean, and then there's this whole idea about meme magic and Keck and all that with this election and these
This is all real. Let me just tell you right now. I mean, all this stuff, if you really know what you're doing with the occult, and as I said, I've always been someone who studies it intellectually. I don't practice it. I do believe that unless you're really knowledgeable, it can have a negative. It can bounce back on you unless you're a real expert at it. So I've seen people who are real experts at the occult practice it, and they seem to know what they're doing. And I think there's absolutely something to it. And obviously with Keck and with Pepe and this kind of meme that's been floating around, I think there's definitely been some magic being evoked. So we'll see if it has any effect November 8th. I'm thinking it will.
So Aristic radicalism is sort of the notion, it's opposed to the idea of equality, that a society exists to enable and empower great individuals and minds. And exactly. A lot of this has its roots in sort of a Nietzschean philosophy.
I think it does. There's a really great book I've been reading at the moment, and Colin Liddell wants me to review it when I finish it. I've been taking my time with it. Some philosophy books I read in a week, some take me like, you know, 2 or 3 months. This one I'm nearly finished, but it's been taking me a little while to read. It's called by Hugo Droshon, Nietzsche's Great Politics. It's a new book that's come out, and I highly recommend it to people. And, you know, basically it examines, Nietzsche's politics has always been controversial because of its links to Nazism. And, you know, obviously the Nazis considered Nietzsche as a kind of forerunner. And I think there's a strong case that to a certain extent he was for the Nazi movement. Obviously, he wasn't particularly anti-Semitic, though he did say some anti-Semitic things. So, I don't know, everyone gets carried away with the anti-Semitic stuff, which I don't even think that Nazism was essentially about anti-Semitism either, but, like, it's a side issue. But I think that with Nietzsche, it's a different kind of approach to examining humanity than you get with Rousseau and, you know, the kind of, like, intellectuals connected to the French Revolution,
John Locke,
Voltaire, people like this. So he's a real reaction against that. And obviously he's using elements of Hegelian philosophy. He's using elements of Kierkegaard to create a new kind of thinking. And I think he really does that in his work. It's amazing that, like, actually, like, Nietzsche is actually an advocate of slavery. Not many people know that. I mean, a lot of left-wing people like to claim Nietzsche as someone who is of the left at times. Obviously, there's the book by Deleuze that my friend Jack Sargent loves to throw around Facebook. Oh, he's a left, he's a radical libertarian. I don't know, whatever.
Perception is that, like, Nietzsche talks about, like, slavery. Well, there's the concept of, like, a slave morality, but also, exactly, like, slaves could be, like, just the conformist masses.
But there is this left-wing argument, though, that is given. I mean, all the people that you mentioned before, they're all German idealist philosophers. And there is this argument that's given. It's thrown at Heidegger. It's thrown at Nietzsche, and it's thrown at Hegel. And Max Stirner is, like, kind of in that, but it's thrown at him too. Where these leftists, you know, for the past 50 or so years, have been taking these German idealist thinkers and molding their ideas to fit into a left wing milieu.
Yes, true. Yes, true. It's true. And I think we need to liberate these thinkers back to their true, meaning and dimension. There's a fascinating discussion in this Nietzsche's Great Politics where the writer examines a debate that occurred around the time of the writing of The Birth of Tragedy, where Nietzsche advocates slavery. There's a whole chapter that advocated slavery that was removed from The Birth of Tragedy. And he was arguing with Wagner, who's, like, you know, of course, quite a famous proto-fascist and kind of, like, right-wing thinker and anti-Semite, who was arguing in a basically against slavery. He was like, oh, no, that's too, you know, that's too old school, that's too ancient Greece, you know what I mean? And, basically, Wagner is the liberal of the two, you know what I mean? Going, oh, no, we can't advocate slavery, Nietzsche. You're getting a bit carried away there, mate. You know? And there's this great discussion back and forth between the two of them. So that's kind of well covered in this new book. So, yeah, I mean, I'd say Nietzsche's really quite a radical conservative in many ways. Though I do agree, as you say, that his idea of slavery, I mean, it would not be of the slavery of, say, in the South in America. It would be that, you know, for example, I mean, the majority of people today are wage slaves. I mean, men and women. I mean, feminism, if anything, has just enslaved women to the system of materialist wage slavery. I mean, women aren't free. Basically, nobody is free outside of the global 20% elite.
I mean, women have, the U.S., you know, within each past, they passed a bill, women are now eligible to be drafted. So, you know, equality has just made women another slave to the system.
Absolutely. There's new memes going around about women joining the military to fight, like, fascism in Russia.
That's right-wing propaganda. Those are fake. They're meant to troll Hillary supporters.
I believe it's meme magic, and obviously it's meant to troll, as you say, Hillary supporters. But obviously there's some truth in it. I think if Hillary were to win, I would not be surprised if you see women being drafted, and I think this is an incredible tragedy. I mean, the result of feminism is that women are going to be forced to go to war and be shot up by soldiers who are all men and who are all extremely well-trained in killing people by Russians. I mean, this is a great tragedy. Hopefully it will not come to this. I do strongly believe that Donald Trump is actually going to win. I think I wrote an essay for Alternative Right where I said that the globalist elite should drop Hillary. He's basically cancer. And, take up the Donald. He would even maybe protect some of their own interests because their own decisions to kind of like start World War III with Russia is self-destructive into their own class.
Yes, I think that's happening now. I think the globalist elite are sort of switching sides and seeing that Donald Trump might actually, even though he's against their platform, he might actually be the one who prevents their annihilation. So I sort of see that happening.
Mate. He's the man. So it's great. And I think it's happening. I had a bet. I mean, obviously, I've had a few opportunities to bet with different people, but I actually took the bet of David Kolstein.
Oh, yeah.
I saw that. $100 cash on the knocker. You know, $100 Australian we agreed on because we couldn't agree what. So it's only going to cost
you. What does that translate into US dollars?
$75 he'll lose, right?
Typical.
Trump wins. Otherwise, I'll be at 100 Australian smackers. But anyway,
yeah, I got I have a $150 bet with my roommate.
Oh, good. There you go. Who did you bet on?
Well, Trump. Last summer.
I was extremely pessimistic. I thought he was going to lose, but then this recent email investigation came up, and now, I mean, he has a good chance of winning.
I think so. You know, and I think as long as I think Hillary could cheat this, but if it's like, you know, if by 5% maybe. But I think Trump's going to win by more than 5%, so that he's going to be unable to cheat that. And I think the globalists know it, and that they've thrown in a little bit with him now. And that, you know, they'll do a Trump deal, and that he's going to limit their power, but I think he will also help. And, you know, and I think in some ways he will help Israel. I mean, there's talk of moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. I mean, you know, if you want someone who's going to shore up the, you know, Israel-Palestine problem, I think Trump could be your man.
If you analyze Trump's policies, it's all about kind of compromising on economics. On one hand, he's giving tax cuts to the 1%, but then he's giving, like, protectionism to the working class. On foreign policy, he's pro-Israel, but at the same time, he's going against, like, the globalist agenda in Syria with, like, toppling Assad.
So Trump also said that he would be neutral on Israel and Palestine. And I trust him to stay with that because he seems to be a deal maker, you know. And I hope he does stay neutral on that issue.
And I think as a president, if he gets elected, he's probably going to be pretty, actually, like, centrist and pragmatist.
Of course, and that's what I like about the guy. I mean, I think, you know, he's going to, be kind of interested in dialectics. You know, he will take different positions and find middle ground. I mean, you know, I mean, if you want the person who's the real radical and even the real kind of, like, dangerous kind of fascist in a bad sense, you know, that's Hillary, who is going to just push agendas, you know, through that are not popular with anybody, that are very destructive, you know, which is World War III with Russia and stealing everybody's guns. I mean, you know, I mean, taking away everyone's guns. I mean, I don't think that's popular with anybody. And, you know, it's just, you know, ridiculous, really. And I think, you know, Trump, you'll find, will be a centrist right winger. I think he'll be nationalist on some things. Some people on the alt-right, I mean, from the Daily Stormer angle, are probably going to be pissed off because he will do things that will support Israel at times, and I don't see a problem with that, and I don't get involved in that whole far, far right end of things because I think it's a load of fucking bullshit. You know?
Would you agree with this? In some ways, Trump is more of a radical centrist, but he has to sort of give out, like, the GOP talking points?
Well, I think that it's funny because all of the conservatives will call Donald Trump a liberal, and all of the liberals will call Donald Trump a fascist.
And well, the funny thing is, like, the conservative types simultaneously say he's too fascist and too liberal. Like,
yeah, well, that's cognitive dissonance. It's cognitive dissonance. They're just playing. They're playing both sides of the field there. I mean, the thing is, Donald Trump is basically a threat to the establishment. You know, he's a threat to the media.
He did make an interesting point. He did in his latest Gettysburg address thing. He came out in favor of like antitrust legislation to break up media monopolies.
I mean, that was beautiful. I mean, all this stuff he's saying is this such great news? And it's like, if it was said by someone like Bernie Sanders, you know, the media would be all over.
Yeah, people would be into wonderful. It.
I mean, he really has come up with some truly amazing ideas, particularly that they come from the mouths of a Republican. He has created a revolution within the Republican Party. I think the only people that are truly threatened by him are the corrupt Republicans, you know, who just are basically corrupt bastards who are globalists and have no interest in protecting the American people or even helping them. And the same on the Democratic side. There are even Democrats who you can tell like Trump, probably even Bernie deep down would like a lot of stuff that Trump is doing, but this, they can't say it publicly for various reasons. You know, remember that Michael Moore thing that went viral?
Sure, yeah.
The Trump thing is a kind of the greatest fuck you in history. Now, I watched that whole documentary, which isn't very good and not worth your time, but that particular 5 minutes is great, you know. But he knew, too, that would be edited and used as a pro-Trump thing. So he hides a pro-Trump diatribe within the context of his broader pro-Hillary, dialogue, which is weak and just, you know, but he has to say that because I mean, even though he doesn't think it will win, he says everywhere, no, Trump's going to win. You know what I mean? So a lot of left-wingers are secret Trump supporters. So this is the truth of the matter. And I do think that you're going to see a very interesting event happen. It's going to be Brexit 2. It's going to be Donald Trump triumphant November 8th, November 9th, when we get the results, hopefully. Okay?
Well, there is
that. So kind of a topic about like aristocratic individualism.
Sure.
What's interesting about Trump is he's more kind of from like the mercantile elite, but at the same time he's like challenging the system.
He is that kind of person. He is an aristocratic radical. I mean, obviously he was given like $1 million he was right. I mean, when he made that joking speech, you know.
Many people win the lottery? You know, they win $100 million and then a year later they're poor. Who's that? Mike Tyson, wasn't he spending $1 million a day or something? You know, so you know, Donald Trump was given one farm,
and he turned it into, I mean, you know, that's like someone getting $10,000 and running a multi-million-dollar business. So it doesn't often happen. You know what I mean? Like, you know, he was given $1 million and started a billion-dollar empire that's been successful for close to 50 years now. So, like, you know, I mean, the man is no slouch. And obviously the guy knows what he's doing. And I think the fact that he comes from the business world is a tremendous boon. You know, I think the American economy is in a lot of trouble. So for somebody, even his dodgy side, even if he's done a few dodgy things, you know what I mean?
Yeah, because the thing is, I mean, maybe he has done some shady stuff, but you kind of have to be a little bit corrupt to deal with all these corrupt types of power.
Yeah, I mean, America owes money to people who are dodgy. So why does he, I mean, he's obviously burned a few people on a few debts here and there, but I mean, wouldn't it be good if he said, oh, how much do we owe China again? Well, fuck you. We don't owe you that. What are you going to fucking do? You know what I mean? I mean, there's things like this. I mean,
yeah, I mean, I think we should. Obviously, like, with the whole debt thing, we can, like, cut all the benefits and do everything, and we still can't pay our deficits.
We owe you that?
We really just have to, like, default on our debt to China and these other countries and just kind of, like, start from scratch.
He would just say, you've been manipulating. He would justify it, too. You've been manipulating the currency. You've been doing something illegal. Okay, well, that's voided that deal. So in the fact that he could, for example, go bad debts on, you know, American money that it might owe to Saudi Arabia even. Okay, September 11. I think you're involved in that. What do we owe you again? We don't owe you that anymore. Fuck you. You know what I mean? This is beautiful. You know, this is just so great. And the fact that he can do that, I mean, I know Anne Sturzinger was going, oh, no, he burnt some poor painter. It's like, ugh, whatever. Like, you know, that might not have been great that he burnt some painter or, you know, $1,000 or $10,000. I don't support what he did there. But the fact that he could use that skill of burning people, you know, on the global stage to America's enemies, basically telling them to go fuck themselves. And what are they going to do? They're going to do nothing. You know, they're just going to have to wear it. And then, you know, I think the economy will boom under Donald Trump. It'll be like the 1980s all over again, but the 1980s on steroids.
So with kind of aristocratic radicalism, we talked about this on the previous show, is kind of the way society functions is you have this, like, you have the slave class use kind of the Nietzschean dialect, who exploit the slave class, and these sort of aristocratic individuals, some of them kind of rise up and do great things, or a lot of them, they drop out and go kind of like to the margins of society. Alex, remember that was on our show we did about
Mishima? Sure, yeah, we have the dialectic between the gamma and the sigma.
Aristocratic individualist, what it basically is, I mean, an aristocratic individualist, they can have different political ideologies. They could hypothetically be a conservative. They could be a Marxist, even a libertarian. My definition of it is it's an individual who has their own very kind of clear vision of how society should be, of the ideal society, and that puts them at odds with society. So you have some of those individuals who go on to be like great successful as writers, artists, film directors, even politicians.
I think you could say
have aristocratic individualists who fail. And some of these individualists just kind of drop out, but you also have people who lash out at society.
I think you could say that they're utopian at some level. You know, I mean, for example, I was just up at the house of, I was locationing for my new feature, and I was up at my friend David Thrussell from the band Snob. He's a far left winger. Even though, you know, he has some conservative views on a few things, I won't go into the details because you probably won't want to share those. But, like, you know, he's quite far left and has been a Marxist all his life. But we almost agree on just about everything, you know what I mean? Like, we're sitting around, he supports Trump, you know, I support Trump. You know, I mean, of the choice of the two anyway. I mean, we probably would have supported Bernie.
Who is this?
You know, a friend of mine, David Thrussell. He's in a band called Snob. They release a lot of very interesting electronic music for the last 25 years that critiques capitalism, and it kind of like sends it up. It's extremely fantastic band. So I highly recommend everyone in the alt-right and the alt-left take a look at David Thrussell and Snog. His stuff is fantastic. And he's just released a new album and a new single. So, you know, check it all out online. So,
yeah, I mean, I think we've sort of ended up in this place where we're almost a little more alt-left than we are alt-right, in that at least Robert and I and other people we have on the show, we're just huge critics of capitalism. And I know you are as well.
I agree. I think that, you know, I mean, I'm not too au fait. I mean, obviously I've seen some stuff on the alt-left, and obviously Robert was kind enough to send me a couple of little links before this.
I sent you that Rabbit's Manifesto, which has been published on Countercurrents.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, I would probably consider myself in that area a bit. I mean, the aspect of the left I'm not too au fait with is, I guess, what you'd call the libertarian economic theory stuff, the Milton Friedman stuff, which is very materialist and, you know, just, you know, that basically you can do whatever you like financially and blah, 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 blah. No, I have no desire to do to the economy what the USSR did. Or, for example, I've been to Cuba, and the economy there is particularly, you know, mainly due to American sanctions. You know, the economy is lousy there, sadly. And so I don't want to do that. I don't want to get rid of capitalism to the point where the economy is just, like, you know, very...
Yeah,
owned by the state or something.
I don't want, like, full-on communism, but, like, the economic system of, say, Germany minus the migrant crisis.
Well, I mean, I think
capitalism, just let me finish this for a second. I think that it's extremely dynamic. Capitalism is, if you go to somewhere like Hong Kong or Thailand or Bangkok, and capitalism is an extraordinary power, you know, that generates vast sums of money. I mean, we're talking, you know, vast sums. And that, you know, the people who create, you know, who are the capitalists, they have every right to benefit to a certain extent. I just think through taxation and through limitations and through some tariffs and laws that we can bring some of this money back and feed it into the, you know, so that some of it can be used to basically help everybody. You know what I mean? Now, the rich can still get richer. You know what I mean? And it's not like we're going to ever get rid of the rich. It's just that, you know, we can just ameliorate the system so that it's a little bit fairer, and that will then provide the ground through which aristocratic individuals will rise and save the human race through a brilliant many, you know, kind of raft of you know, brilliant ideas, whether it be in art and technology and science and stuff. And I think this is the kind of environment that Nietzsche envisaged, which is a kind of utopian, futuristic, you know, kind of vision, I think. And
so
it's quite powerful.
We've hit peak dystopia, and we're almost ready to smack the wall into utopia.
something like that.
The kind of question is, how do you create a society, implement practical policies that empower aristocratic individualists?
Great things. One of the great things about aristocratic radicals is they rise anyway. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I mean, you don't have to help an aristocratic individual that much. They're going to do it anyway.
Richard.
You know what I mean? Whether they come from the working class or whether they, you know, have been spoiled all their life by their rich parents and, you know, have never really had, you know, had to kind of like, you know, struggle. They have to. That's also something to overcome in a way because for whatever reason, you know, when you're spoiled all your life, you know, that spoils you basically and you don't become as hungry for something in life. I think personally, I think the best class to be born into is the lower middle class. And then, you know, hopefully through a life of struggle, you reach either the upper middle class to live sort of more comfortably and are able to do what you want, which is, I guess, sort of what I'm trying to do with my own kind of struggle or whatever, in the sense that, you know, I just, I like being hungry. I don't ever want to be so wealthy that I'm no longer hungry. You know, you see a lot of stars, you know, I mean, it happens in all musicians or filmmakers. They get so much money or success, they become lazy, you know, they become, oh, well, I'll just spend a life, you know, doing what I want to do, whether it be travel or whoring around or, you know, just, I don't know, opening a truffle farm or something, you know what I mean? So, you know, I think aristocratic individuals will arise anyway. That's the good thing about them. And we only need to help them a little bit. Sometimes it's only a little assistance here or there, maybe a little funding for a film or an art project or a book or publishing a book. Say Adam Parfrey might publish someone's book and launch the career of, say, someone like Michael Moynihan. He's a great writer and also someone who I consider kind of one of the godfathers of the alt-right. So I think it's a fascinating kind of whole nexus. And that, you know, with the internet, this is, you know, bringing a lot of this stuff together. That's one of the positives of it.
What I was going to say before is I was watching a speech Richard Spencer gave at NPI in like 2011. And he showed stock footage of Enoch Powell giving a speech. And he interjected cuts of immigration protests from the mid-70s and the London riots in 2011. Now, I had never seen immigration protests in England of the time. And, you know, I was born in 1989. I'm a fairly young person. And to see this image of people in the 1970s, people who have always been depicted to me as being hippies, you know, these dudes with long hair and their handlebar mustaches and these hippie chicks, and they all have signs that say, "Stop immigration now. Enoch was right." And to see
remembered that, you know, I mean, the Beatles even did a song, Get Back.
Which
is basically about, you know, sending Pakistani immigrants back home. I mean, if you look at there's an uncut version online where it includes lines about Pakistanis. And obviously, Laback did a cover of it where it brought out the get back to where you once belong aspect of it. You know what I mean? So I think there has been a reaction. And I mean, I know people from the 60s. Who share this view, who are part of the 60s. I won't say some of them are quite famous Australian musicians, but they definitely share my view apropos of immigration. So this has been a problem even within the hippie community. I think even within their utopian vision that the hippies had, you know, they could see that it was something that couldn't be applied universally to every single person on the human race. And that if you open the borders so that everybody in the third world suddenly floods into the first world, well, you know, we're no longer going to have a first world. We're just going to have a giant third world.
Yeah, it just benefits like the globalist 1%. I remember on our last show, I mean, the only way to defeat them is kind of to unite the dissident right and dissident left.
Yeah, I agree, boys. You know, it's been fascinating. You know, I mean, watching this debate about the globalists, and I mean, obviously, I wrote that essay recently for Alternative Right and Colin Dell. You know, I think the one about Trump and the globalist elite. You know, I mean, you know, a lot of people equate that with the, you know, what's it called, inverted commas, the Jews or whatever. But I disagree. I mean,
there are echoes.
Many people who I, you know, the Saudis, for example, are globalists, and there are people that, you know, the EU, the Eurotrash, you know, out of Belgium, these are all European people, and there are members of the aristocratic class in England, and there are a lot of Anglos, and also, obviously, Anglos in US politics, people like Bush, Cheney, these kind of people. So, you know, I think it's a real mixed bag of people that are part of this globalist agenda, and if you really look at, use the more the word plutocrat, you know, oligarch. This better describes the situation, I think.
I remember you said a while, you said on our last show, like, you would support, like, a cap of income of, like, $100 million to limit their power. I know you got into, like, a debate with Jim Goad about that topic.
Did you? What did Jim say about it?
Well, weren't you guys fighting in a car
when you were hanging out? Jim Goad and I, we had a debate about that. Not 100 million. I would say we shouldn't have billionaires, which means so if you have $999 million, which really is a lot of money, you could basically have a house in France, a house in London, a house in New York, LA, and Melbourne, and you still have a lot of change left over from $999 million. You could have I'm talking mansion. You could have a $10 million mansion in each city and still have a lot of change. So I really think there doesn't need to be billionaires. Whatever business you want to build, if you were to reinvest, say you got to $999 million and then you just reinvested everything in your business or giving, shares and money back to the people who work for you, I think that's a reasonable thing to do. There just must be ways. The world does not need billionaires, basically. You know what I mean? You can still own 10 Picassos and be, and have $999 million. So
excess wealth is not, it's not necessarily used. That's plenty for your own lavish income, but that excess wealth is used to corrupt the political system.
I think it's used to corrupt things. It's also stored. This idea of trickle-down effect, once people begin to earn over a billion, when they've got 10 billion or 100 billion, this money is just stored often in offshore accounts, but even if it's stored legally within the West, it just sits there gaining, obviously, a lot of interest and, it's invested in various different ways, but, it's not put back into the economy, which I think is one of the reasons why we're seeing the global economy kind of becoming so stultified, so solidified, and this kind of economic inequity is becoming so vast. You know what I mean? And nothing seems to be done about it. Obviously, Jim and I, when we shot the film The Second Coming, Volume 2, which he has a part in, he plays one of the leads in the second movie. Jim and I don't normally get along, and I love Jim, and I love a lot of what he has to say. And I think on the way to the airport, I just began to express a couple of my more socialist ideas on the economy. I would say that Jim has a more Milton Friedman, laissez-faire capitalism, and I was like, why do you support that?
It's not when I read this article back then, when I first interviewed it, I had no idea who you were, and I think the article is called The Human Centipede of Envy, but it kind of portrays you as like this... effete, like a bourgeois liberal. The context is you were coming back from a trip, you were making a documentary in Africa, and then he says, why don't you give your money to those people in Africa who would, envy your wealth?
I don't think my ideas come from the idea of envy. I think that was the way that, he
You think you took them out of context?
Well, yeah, I think so. I think with Jim, Jim basically works for a libertarian capitalist, Taki, who basically has that view of the economy. So I think, he has to express that kind of idea, even though, his book, The Red Deck Manifesto, has a kind of socialist aspect where he says that the black and white community, rather than hate each other racially, have more to share, but in the sense that they are both economically disadvantaged. Mm.
Well, the thing is, Richard, I think the problem that Jim has is more or less with the state and his utter distrust of people. So if the state is going to come knocking at my door and take money from me and tell me that it's going to go to helping the kids and making life better, and life doesn't get better, then suspicion arises.
See, I think Jim doesn't understand what I'm talking about. This is something that would only be applied to a very small percentage of people, which is basically the mega 1% elite. I can't see any of us in our circle, even the most well-to-do. Say someone like Adam Parfrey, who's quite well off. I can't ever see him reaching anywhere near $999 million. So I don't think anyone has anything to fear from my ideas on that. Maybe Gina Reinhart, George Soros, they might be worried about it. But this is, we're talking a very small percentage of people. There would probably only be 1,000 people in the world, maybe, might be affected by such an idea. Within the realm of Western civilization. But anyway, this is just a, it's an ideological difference. Obviously I respect Jim Goad's position, and I'm fully aware of it. I think Boyd Rice has a similar position apropos the economy. I guess I've also read books on socialism, and have not always opposed some of the more moderate ideas about limiting the kind of excesses of capitalism and the excesses of wealth. And that's the aspect I come to it. I don't know if I'm some effete I don't think so. I mean, when I made that film, Africa to make that film, I mean, I didn't fund that film at all. That was funded by Ebony Butler and a partner of hers. And that was all paid for by them, you know. So I basically
was that about the Civil War in Rwanda?
It was about the Civil War with the Joseph Kony. We went there before that whole Kony 2012 thing. We were there in 2009. I really loved going to Uganda. I thought it was a fascinating country. The poverty there is extraordinary, absolutely. But I mean, I wasn't sitting around, talking about liberal humanism about how we can help the Ugandan people. I was sitting around with the locals talking about Idi Amin, what a great guy he was, and isn't he a lot of fun? And don't you all miss him? And they said, Idi was fantastic. They also said we miss the colonials. We wish the white man, who they call the Mzungu. They wish the Mzungu would come back because they said the people running our country now are completely corrupt. He said, well, under the Mzungu, you get a fair wage. And obviously we had a driver when we went north and, you know, he was being paid something like $300 for the month. And that was very, very well paid for this person. And we gave him another $300 tip just as a whatever, you know, thanks, God, mate. And, you know, this was a lot of money. And the house he was living in with his family was not the kind of place you'd put your dog.
Well, you know, what's interesting is, Karl Marx would call the opinions of most, you know, soi-disant liberals, he would call their opinions bourgeois decadence, because they have these opinions on the poor from all around the world, but they don't go to these countries. And when they do go to these countries, they you don't go about them in a very safe way. They stay at the resort or something. They don't go and talk to the locals and have real experience. I mean, there was an article on Alternative Right, you know, on Colin Liddell's website. You know, they have the one Filipino writer. And
Siriaco Acta. Yeah, I've been interviewing him a couple times.
I read an article that he did on Duterte in the Philippines. And there's just this idea of, you know, the right-wing third world person. And that's, I think, most people in the third world kind of, in a way, crave a form of authoritarianism to have order, because it's chaos without that order. And the big man of the village just controls everyone unless there's some kind of higher order. So maybe this can be a nice segue into the transcendental fascism thing? Or
sure, that sounds like a good...
Transcendental fascism... You describe it, so this is like your concept, you describe it as more peaceful form of fascism, that it's transcendental, it doesn't put the main emphasis on racial lines, but it more adheres to the principles of aristocratic radicalism. It attempts to create a fascism that reinvents itself along dialectical lines towards the absolute, but also it transcends a lot of the negative aspects of fascism. It's interesting, as you were saying, like, you agree with a lot of maybe classical liberal principles like freedom of speech.
I do.
So yes. Transcendental fascism could incorporate, it's not a rigid ideology, like you can incorporate things like...
Basically, it's not a totalitarian situation. And basically, I mean, look, if I could compare it to something on the left, I mean, I think that, you know, when you see someone like, for example, Slavoj Žižek, who calls himself a communist, and he's interested in kind of like reinventing some kind of communism or whatever, but I don't think he wishes to bring back Stalin, you know what I mean? So, you know, I have a similar interest in right-wing things, you know, in the sense that I have an interest in fascism, and I have an interest in fascist politics. But when I talk about, you know, reinventing such a thing, I don't wish to bring back even if you don't go into the exact details of what went on in the death camps or the concentration camps, but I don't want to bring back the idea of the camp system really at all. You know what I mean? Like, you know, there are ways to do these things without being, what I would consider totalitarian or extremely authoritarian. I mean, obviously, you know, there are, for example, Australia has offshore camps, for example, for immigrants at the moment, you know, who refugees who come. So I'm all right with something like that. You know, because these are people trying to get into our country illegally, and we have to let them know that this is not right. And there's 1,000 or 2,000 there at the moment that can go home anytime they like, but we're just not going to let them into our country.
And obviously, but couldn't you make the case that you're kind of playing into the hands of like the establishment who wants to equate like immigration restriction with fascism?
It's a high concept, this kind of thing. Within the alt-right, I mean, you know, there's no doubt in my mind from looking at a lot of the writings that definitely what people are dealing with on the alt-right and even the alt-left to a certain extent are ideas that have arisen around the question of fascism, in the sense that these are not communist ideas and these are not capitalist ideas. These are third way ideas, and I guess that connects to the world of fascist and right wing politics on that area of the political spectrum. So I don't think it's unusual to talk about it. Some people don't like to use the F word because, you know, it's a word that's become, you know, you can call anyone a fascist, from the,
sure,
the policeman who gives you a ticket when you were like, oh, I was only there a minute, mate, you know, kind of thing. So, you know, become a word of insult, but, you know, I'm trying to reclaim it a little.
Yes,
obviously,
yes.
I did at my university thesis. I don't use this phrase all the time. I mean, I do think it's interesting the way what I was talking about with transcendental fascism has become almost, you know, it was almost like a prophecy in a way of what happened with the alt-right, because alt-right is a kind of expression. You know, I mean, you've got the alt-right and you've got to say what's going on with, you know, the Daily Stormer, which is traditional far-right neo-Nazism, say. You know, but I think there's a distinct difference between that and this alt-right thing. And the idea that the alt-right is a bit nicer and a bit more friendly, and that, you know, Milo can be a part of it, and you know, Jewish people are most welcome to be a part of it, and all this, and it's and there's no one's, well, there are still a few people running around going kike or whatever, you know, saying, using fucking racial epithets or whatever, you know, but like, you know, but it's that's not the center of it, you know what I mean? Like it's moving the discourse of the right, on even of fascism, and moving it to a more mainstream place. And if people want to accuse me of, I don't know, making it being bourgeoisie or decadent for doing that, I don't know, maybe I am a little bit, who knows? I mean, I used to run an S&M club, that's not something everybody does.
I was talking to a friend of mine last night about Hans Hermann Hoppe, and I said to him, like, well, you know, Hans Hermann Hoppe calls himself an anarcho-fascist. And he said to me, you have to understand, he's more than likely using that phrase in an antagonistic way. Like, I'm going to give you my opinions and tell you that I'm an immigration restrictionist and I am very skeptical of capitalism. It's like, well, if I add those two together, you sound like a national socialist, you sound like a fascist. So if the word fascist is going to be the thing that people are going to throw at me, if I just claim it myself and call myself an anarcho-fascist to begin with, it's basically a way of saying, all right, come at me, fuckers. I'm already going to say that I am the thing you think I am. So deal with me now.
That was the reason I chose the phrase transcendental fascism, because really it came of my studying philosophy at La Trobe University, political philosophy from the years 1999 to 2003, sorry, that was when I studied it, and everybody in class, in philosophy class, was a left-winger. And obviously, we were studying Nietzsche, Heidegger, and Carl Jung, which are all people who are of the right, really, and I was the one right-winger in class, and basically, I was talking to my, you know, Robert Farrell, who's my kind of like thesis, you know, what's it called? He's my teacher, basically, or, you know, what's it called?
Professor?
At a university level. Professor, there you go. And you know, I just said, look, I just think some of these ideas have been connected to fascism and stuff, and I have this idea of calling it transcendental fascism. And he said, go ahead, mate. That'll really annoy everybody in class, and I'll have a good laugh, you know.
It's controversial, but it's the provocative title. It gets your attention. If you have like a very bland title, people are going to be like, oh, whatever.
I was also interested in, you know, like David Lynch was interested in transcendental meditation. And even though I admire that, and I've tried meditating a few times, I just thought it was a little bit of a wank. You know what I mean? Like I said, you know, David Lynch is into transcendental meditation, and I'm into transcendental fascism.
Yeah.
Well, you can make a case that he's an aristocratic radical.
I don't doubt, I'm a huge fan of David Lynch, but just that aspect of him, you know, he's always going on about, you know, I mean, you know, oh, everything's about, it's bringing about. I mean, you know, David Lynch is someone who is clearly a spiritual person who's interested in the light and the dark. But if I was to say that what aspect of David Lynch comes through in his web series or in his films and in his TV shows, it's the dark side, mate. Like, you know, he is, what makes his stuff powerful is not the fact that he's interested in spirituality. It's the fact that he has some weird connection to what is dark in the universe, like all that stuff about Bob and you know, like the Red Room and the Little Dwarf, and it's all incredibly like reeked and evil.
You know? Have you seen David Lynch talking about 9/11 on that French TV show?
He's a conspiracy theorist, isn't he?
So yeah, and they ask him, you know, what do you think that this is about? And David Lynch goes, "Oh, it's too big. I can't say, it's too big. Like, he doesn't want to really go into it. And when you watch his films, particularly his newer films, like, Inland Empire or Mulholland Drive, there's this idea of the dark men in the shadows. So it seems like David Lynch has played in, he knows he's sort of aware, and maybe transcendental meditation is a way for him to get out of reality, because he just knows how dark it truly is.
And he's also been involved with, like, kind of dissident politics. What's interesting is, like, politically, he's kind of been all over the place. He started out as, like, a libertarian who admired Ronald Reagan. Then he was involved with, like, the Natural Law Party, which is, they're kind of like a, they're an interesting party because they're kind of a new age into environmentalism. Yeah, but I think they also favored, like, immigration restriction. Then he supported Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, he's an element of an old hippie, but since Bernie has fallen off the perch, he hasn't commented politically. I suspect.
Yeah, I've noticed that too.
I suspect he's a Trump man, but won't say it because obviously there are political ramifications to say that in Hollywood. I've got a couple of Hollywood friends who I won't name who basically are of that position that they support Trump, but they can't say it publicly.
They're in the Trump closet. And it seems like David Lynch probably likes the kind of all American elements of Trump. I mean, there is like an artist's view of Trump. You know, the authentic artist. And we can see him as, like, you know, an all-American figure and a return of authenticity, where Hillary Clinton is just, you know, fake egalitarian universalist capitalist bullshit.
And if you kind of look at the persona of, like, a Trump and, like, Trump Tower, I mean, you could say it's gaudy, but there is something kind of aristocratic individualist about it, in the sense he does have his own very, like, unique aesthetic.
If you think about what Trump is saying with Make America Great Again, and then you look at the opening of Blue Velvet, that is it, that the white picket fence, the kind of like the community that's united, and then this kind of relatively ethnically united as well, you know, kind of the white middle-class America, the kind of fireman and the nice person, you know, who's, you know, helping children across the street, you know, and this is the kind of America that I think, you know, I mean, obviously Nietzsche grew up in the, sorry, not Nietzsche, David Lynch grew up in the, in the 1950s, so, you know, this is a world that would be familiar to him, and powerful, and I think this is the world that, you know, I mean, the world of our childhoods is essentially what Donald Trump is evoking with that phrase, you know, the myth of the palingenetic renewal, which is actually a fascist idea, you know, that Trump is using in this election.
Well, I remember, like, with kind of that all-left manifesto, I remember in an article, like, Rabbit commented, like, he suggested, like, why not a, like, chic, liberal, futurist, like, soft fascism?
Well, there are different variations of this. And obviously, I think one of the great things about the alt-right is that it allows all these different views to be expressed. I mean, obviously, I don't think my own opinions are the last word on any of these topics. I think it's an interesting debate, and that we have people like Jim Goad, people like yourselves, people like Colin Liddell, Andy Nowicki, Anne Sterzinger, and obviously some of the larger figures like Milo Yiannopoulos, even some people from more the far, far right aspect of it, and even the Daily Stormer aspect can have their say. You know, I think this is all part of a broader conversation, and that I think that's why this movement, you know, has some legs. And I mean, there was many predictions of its death, I don't know, 6 months ago or something, when Trump began to flounder a little. But I can't see this movement going away. And I think, particularly with the Trump win, it's only going to get stronger. And basically, I think, can become like the neocon movement, but a lot more dynamic, in the sense that it's not just a group of, you know, like Paul Wolfowitz and Dick Cheney, you know, playing chess inside the Pentagon, but, you know, a group of diverse individuals, you know, really discussing real ideas to do with ideology and to do with, you know, the political manifest destiny of Western civilization.
Yeah, well, it seems like the Trump movement has been the thing that's, like, just captured everyone from the various weirdo movements. You know, there's leftover people from Occupy Wall Street that have been thrown into it. There's plenty of Tea Party people who have been thrown into it. There's alt-right people. There's, what was, like, the truth movement, like, the government did 9/11. It's sort of like all the strange...
Alex Jones is like a hardcore Trump supporter.
Yeah, exactly.
Now.
So it's like all the weird people, everyone who's been thrown out of the mainstream by the, you know, PC oligarchs, sort of the world has become paused and totally PC. And like, you know, at first it was just one guy did something bad and he was kicked out. Another guy did something bad. He was kicked out. Some girl said something that was sort of racist. She was kicked out.
Yeah,
and eventually we realized that we were all kicked out. And we looked around, and we'd all been kicked out.
In a way, we're outsiders, and that we should welcome these people. And there's been a few articles. I think with Gregory Johnson, is that his name, or Gregory Jordan?
Oh, Greg Johnson from Countercurrents.
Yeah. He wrote this article that Milo should be, you know, kicked out of the alt-right kind of thing. And it's like, I just thought, that's just bullshit. Milo's fantastic. I don't particularly like Milo's lifestyle or would advocate it, but, like, I don't have a problem that he lives that way. Good luck to him. You know, but, like, you know, I mean, I have appreciated many of his speeches online. I've shared many of them. Sometimes he's very witty and funny, and, you know, it's clear that the media loves the guy, and he often gets on mainstream media.
Oh, so, yeah, you know, I mean, Milo is basically just playing a media circus.
Yeah, I noticed, like, I read some article on Countercurrents the other day, and I forget it wasn't Greg Johnson, I forget the name of the writer, but there's been all these articles, like, defining what is alt-right, what it isn't, but I think that's beyond the point, because it's not a specific coherent movement, it's a big tent movement for people who are basically dissidents
kicked out of the mainstream. Kicked out of the mainstream.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I agree. I think the broader we make, obviously we can't make it too broad so that the movement loses its definitions. But I think the fact that we can, you know, have some general ideas and that there can be debate. I mean, I have no problem with these kind of articles attempting to define what the alt-right is. I think that's great. I think we need
this. Oh, the other thing is Matt Forney did a podcast last week complaining that the alt-right is now being too accepting of socialism and homosexuality.
Yeah. I saw that. Yeah. So that's exactly the kind of thing. But then those articles should be there too. You know, maybe it is. Maybe it is going a little bit too much that way. So obviously, to me, the alt-right should obviously remain right-wing to some extent.
Yeah. I mean, what we are offering is an antithesis to the thesis of, you know, modernity and the establishment. So we are just a force that is going against their force. So of course, our force.
Now you're thinking dialectically. You're thinking in a Hegelian sense.
Yes,
yes. So, what are we going to say? What else do we want to talk about? We want to talk about Paul Schrader? Yeah? Is that right?
Sure,
you want to get on the hip? What do you want to say about Paul Schrader? You've been having a bit of a love affair with Paul Schrader on this show, I've noticed. Is it all an argument with him or what?
Oh, no, that was a coincidence that you were fighting with him. We've been talking about Paul Schrader's ideas for a couple months, just me and Robert, and then we decided to do some shows on it.
We did a show on Mishima and Taxi Driver, and then we interviewed Matthew David Wilder, who wrote a film for him, Dog Eat Dog, which is being released this month.
You know, I sent that article on Mishima to Paul Schrader, so he would have seen it by now.
Awesome.
So, yeah, I mean, look, Paul Schrader was, I guess, I mean, I don't know him personally. Obviously, I only know him through Facebook.
Did he respond to the article?
Not that I know of, but I did send it to him. Obviously, we had a little bit of an argument. Like, you know, I've been on his page for probably 6 months to a year. You know, I've been making a few kind of right-wing comments, pro-Trump comments. He's obviously pro-Hillary, at least in public he is. And I don't know what he is in private, but I think he might well be mean what he says. So he's pro-Hillary, and I probably had a big night and was feeling in a cheeky mood, so I was on his page making some kind of proto-fascist kind of comments, and he just quoted a couple of them and then launched this big attack at me, like, you know, like, you're one click away on Facebook from, like, fascism or whatever, and it was like, I mean, you know, I guess he was kind of basically telling me to get fucked, but I thought it was funny and flattering all the same. And then, but he didn't delete me instantly or block me. He left me there so I could basically defend myself, which I thought was kind of nice. And then we just had this big discussion. The thread's still on his page. I think you can still see it. So, you know, it was this huge discussion about politics, and everyone was kind of, you know, some people were having a go at me. Some people were defending me, saying, oh, Richard's connected to, like, Boyd Rice and kind of subversive ideas and, you know, don't just take it on surface level. And so there are people kind of, like, you know, defending what I was saying. And, you know, I think it was an interesting debate, and I was kind of like, you know, making a sending up the conversation slightly along the lines of the film Red Dragon, You know, it's like, you know, like the avid fan when Hannibal Lecter, you know, finds out about the Tooth Fairy and he's like, oh, my dear Dr. Lecter, I'm delighted you've taken an interest in me. You know what I mean? So I was kind of setting it up along those lines. So it was an interesting conversation. But I think that Paul Schrader's work definitely is something of the right. And that's something I said to him. Obviously, films like Taxi Driver, Mishima, Comfort of Strangers particularly, and other stuff. Obviously, that one he did Rolling Thunder? That was like a Vietnam vet coming back, and it was kind of a big revenge kind of film. These films definitely have right-wing themes running strongly throughout them. So I think it was quite relevant that you had done your article about him. And you know, he's someone I would consider, at least part of his work, is something of the right and even the alt-right. Well, I'll invite him to be on the show. And I don't know. I mean, he might agree to it. You never know. So he can defend himself and talk about that. But it was most enjoyable to have this discussion with him. And, you know, he seems like a very interesting person. And also, I do know Bredis and Ellis in Los Angeles. And I do know that they made the film The Canyons. And that's actually how I got to know both of them at first, is I did give them awards for best foreign film, best director, and best screenplay at my film festival. That's when I first made contact with them and joined them on Facebook. That was a couple of years ago.
Well, all of Schrader's films, or not all of them, but a theme that runs through his films is one of individuality and alienation and the idea of turning from like weakness into strength. And to me, that's what fascism is. So I see Schrader as, I mean, some friends of mine have criticized me. I mean, because I always view art as being fascist, you know, like Frank Herbert's Dune, you know. I know that some people who think, like, you know, in the sort of alt-right way, they've said that Dune is like the Bible of the alt-right. And I read Dune in high school and was obsessed with that book. It has religious qualities to it because it has these elements that are evolved out of Islam and Catholicism and Buddhism. So I almost feel like I am of the religion of Dune in ways.
Yeah, I agree. And that has a very strong, I think, right-wing message, the book Dune, and even the film that David Lynch did. I think that's his most, potent political statement. I mean, you know, when you look at, like, you know, like those kind of like, you know, the Baron or whatever is the globalist, the fat Baron.
Oh, are the Harkonnens.
Now, the Harkonnens are perfect representations of the globalists. And, you know, we are obviously the revolutionary side who are going to fight them. So, you know, I think this is a perfect metaphor for what's going on at the moment, you know, and obviously exactly who the, what's the Kwisatz Haderach?
Yeah, yeah. Everyone is gunning for their own spot to be the Kwisatz Haderach.
Who the new Messiah is, I'm not sure, but hey, I look a bit like Tom McLaughlin.
Yeah, I think that's the thing about aristocratic individualism is it's just a group of men all claiming to be the Messiah. And then it's like, well, we all can't be Jesus, so let's just work together so one of us could be.
Well, maybe it's Donald Trump. Maybe he's already arrived, you know. So, you know, I think it's a question of not just one Messiah, but there'll be a succession of Messiahs, hopefully, who will lead us back to the right path. So, you know.
So, Richard, it's been a great show. Before I wrap things up, do you want to plug your movie that's coming out next year?
Well, not really. I don't want to discuss it at the moment, but I can reveal its title. It's called The Debt Collector. It's a new revenge kind of genre film that I've been developing for about 5 years. You know, I've been finishing this film, The Second Coming, Volume 1 and Volume 2, which has been taking a lot of time. And also I've been doing, obviously, my Melbourne Underground Film Festival. But I've got this new film I start shooting next week, so I'm probably going to drop out of the alt-right scene just for about 6 to 8 weeks while I shoot it. Because it's going to be intense because we're going to be shooting in about 4 days a week for about 6 to 7 weeks. But hopefully when that's done, I will then have some time off. I'll probably go on a holiday somewhere and, you know, begin to start writing again. And I'll reflect on the election result. And it's an exciting time ahead. And you'll hopefully hear more about this new film next year, which, and obviously I'll plug it more and a few other things we're doing. But I think you're going to enjoy it. There's actually a character that's going to be of the alt-right in the new film. And I think you're going to enjoy it because he's probably the most crazy character in the whole film.
Oh, interesting.
Richard Wollstonecraft, thanks for being on.
It's a pleasure, boys, and have a great time, and make sure you vote Trump next week, lads.
Richard, it's always a pleasure talking to you. We'll talk to you again soon.
All right, see ya.